Welcome, everybody. My name is Matt Seifer from the Steer Center for Global Real Estate with the Steer's Real Estate Podcast. We're very fortunate to have Kelvin Moses with us today. He's a 2011 alum of Georgetown College, currently an SVP of Investments at a company by the name of Health Peak Properties, which is a publicly traded healthcare REIT. Kelvin has done a lot of stuff while he was at Georgetown. Most notably, though, he's on the Georgetown football team. And he continues to stay very involved with the football team, doing a variety of things as I've seen him around campus, but also he's supporting of our Georgetown real estate program as a member of our advisory board. So, Kelvin, really appreciate you being here today, and thank you for making the time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So let's get started with just a little bit of background on you, Kelvin. Where are you from? How'd you get to Georgetown? You know, give me a little bit of that before we jump into this.
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town in New Hampshire, in Nashua, New Hampshire, about 45 minutes outside of Boston. You know, you'd mentioned a little bit about my Georgetown background being a football player there, but, you know, the collegiate athletics really brought me to the university. It was a priority to me to have a shot at playing Division I football, as well as getting a pretty rigorous academic balance as a part of my college experience. And, you know, Georgetown married the two extremely well. So I landed at Georgetown. Also needed to get out of my New England bubble a little bit, make my way to a true metropolitan area, an environment that was diverse, an environment that, you know, could lead me to think about new opportunities as I was looking even beyond the university. So DC, you know, phenomenal place to grow as a young adult and get exposure to a lot. So Georgetown fit perfectly for what I was looking for.
So just very quickly, let me ask you, you were an English and an economics major. I love that. So talk about how you wound up that path.
So English and economics, it's interesting because when I left Georgetown, I ended up in finance. But, you know, coming into the university, I had a very liberal arts underpinning from high school, and I enjoyed reading and writing quite a bit. It was my strong suit. It was not necessarily a passion, but I knew I could perform while being a student athlete in the classroom with that as a focus. Funny enough, if you ask any of my friends, they would say, Kelvin thought he was in the business school, but he was in the college. And I spent a lot of my time trying to figure out what was next. So, you know, the economics component of my degree and my studies was really to help me bridge the gap from what I thought I wanted on the business side to make myself marketable to go off and do something in that world. And at that time, I had no idea what that was going to be. But, you know, Georgetown provided me with exposure to consulting and investment banking and corporate finance. And, you know, ultimately, you know, the econ foundation really made me marketable to, you know, those groups that I was seeking to be a part of after I graduated.
Well, I love that. And I'm maybe jumping ahead and we're going to come back. So I don't want to leave Georgetown just yet, but it's related. So an ability to write is critical in this business, and an ability to articulate your thoughts. I assume that has done absolutely nothing but help you, especially early on where you were in charge of writing a lot of these books.
I think that's right. And it's funny because I like to say, you know, people refer to business language. I think if you have that, you know, history background or, you know, English background or liberal arts background where you're critically analyzing, reading, dissecting, and then kind of regurgitating in your own words, that kind of translates through business in every facet of it. And from a real estate perspective, you're really describing opportunities. You're trying to create a compelling storyline behind why to invest. So it's 100% directly related. Ultimately, you know, the economics make the investment work and it has to, you know, generate cash returns. But if you can't get people excited about it, you can't write about it, you can't, you know, take imagery and convert that into words, people won't understand the opportunity. So it's hugely valuable.
Well, I love it, man. And we talk a lot about in class that fine line between advocating for a deal and feeling like you're brokering somebody, right? So really being and having a handle on your language in a way that you can be persuasive, but not feel or have your reader feel like they're being brokered. So I love it. So out of curiosity, what position did you play in the football team?
Oh, the Zoom call doesn't let you see that I was an offensive lineman. I think I lose a couple inches and lose a couple pounds, which is a good thing. on the screen, but I played offensive line over there with Rob Scarlotta, great program, great team, you know, probably the best part of my Georgetown experience when I put it all together.
So maybe spend a minute. I think you are still involved in the mentorship capacity in some form, actually, with the football team. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, you know, Rob Scarlatta, Coach Scarlatta, to me, really keeps the alumni base close. Every year, I think, not just me, all of the alum that he reaches out to are tied back into players. And some of that is alumni to alumni, where, you know, it's young alumni with older alumni getting mentorship, getting guidance. And, you know, he did that for me when I was an undergrad. It really kind of catapulted me into Wall Street, frankly. I didn't have any natural exposure to that industry, but it was the football program that gave me the relationships, gave me the connections, alongside a couple other things I was doing at Georgetown, but, you know, primarily there. I think that's one thing that I do appreciate and I love about the program is that, you know, that extends beyond Rob Scarlatta. If it's strength and conditioning coach, if it's the athletic director, I mean, these are folks that are looking to see, you know, student athletes perform outside of the field or the court or, you know, the playing environment and really, you know, develop the entire person. So it was hugely beneficial to me. Loved the opportunity now to give back in my capacity. So wherever I can, I try to be supportive.
Well, that's great. And we're feeling that at the Sears Center and appreciate that. So just maybe a quick run through your career. You left Georgetown and went to Barclays and you were there for almost 7 years in an investment banking capacity, which is a long hitch in a great way. But explain that one a little bit and then maybe you can take it from there in terms of where you went.
Yeah. So not many people stay in investment banking for that long. And I might describe what attracted me to banking and, you know, what preserved me within that environment for so long. And, you know, for me, getting the fundamental skills of, you know, underwriting, financial analysis, technical financial modeling, but also problem solving, critical thinking in one environment with a number of smart people, that felt like it would be an extension to my experience at Georgetown. It was going to challenge me in the right way. It was going to give me the tools to be successful. So I knew I wanted to be there. I had an internship in the summer actually focusing in the TMT segment. So technology, media, telecom, the Googles of the world, the Microsofts of the world, and had a fantastic experience there. But ultimately decided that the healthcare industry was what I wanted to pursue and also would transact through economic cycles. So I was going to get enough reps and volume to develop that base and that skill set that I was looking for. So I joined the healthcare investment banking team in New York, you know, stayed there for about three and a half years and really started to understand, you know, the intricacies of that industry, but was later able to take that and, you know, move offices at Barclays. And I have to go back and say that, you know, those large institutions give you that opportunity for geographic mobility. You know, they provided options to go to London, they had options to go to San Francisco. So for me, you know, my college sweetheart, having been a Georgetown alum from San Diego, I had to find my way to the West Coast and I was able to do that through Barclays. And for a 7-year stint, you know, I've always said to myself, what I love about working is the transaction volume, as well as the diversity of the work. And at Barclays for that 7-year period, I was always challenged, always able to get more reps and always able to get more kind of diverse experiences that I think made me marketable for, you know, that next job, which ultimately brought me to HealthPeak.
Well, and I want to go there next, but what I find so interesting, and I think for the students that are listening, you know, I've had a number of them in class and they're going into banking in areas that aren't necessarily real estate direct. And some could argue maybe healthcare is very similar in that regard, but you have found your way via that as an avenue into a real estate heavy role. And it just gives some, you know, for those of us and the students that are listening, there is an opportunity in some way through whatever you're doing to wind up in real estate using what you learned in the banking route to the extent that's of interest. So you took maybe a non-traditional route into real estate, but it was very effective because you learned the healthcare piece and then the real estate came later, I think.
No, that's absolutely right. And so part of my transition at Barclays, I started doing gaming, lodging, and leisure, which fits within this business. So combining those two segments together, a healthcare REIT platform made natural sense. I think disproportionately to, you know, perhaps others that enter the healthcare real estate industry. You know, I had exposure to the broad base of the tenants that we served, having been on the advisory side from an investment banking perspective. So I understood, you know, how those businesses worked, how they sought to raise capital, how they sought to grow, which, you know, as a real estate investor, you actually have to kind of wear a similar hat, right? You're investing in the asset type of healthcare real estate. But if you don't understand the fundamental components of the industry you serve, you might not be making the best investments. So I think, you know, for all the people that join our team on the investment side of the business, we try to push them more into, you know, kind of a foundational knowledge base within healthcare specifically to be able to underwrite, evaluate, and understand the investments that we're making a little bit more intimately, which I think is critical.
Well, and I love it. And I think you'd agree with this. The, you know, the tenant credit, especially in the healthcare business, is so important. And so you got a firsthand look at how these companies work or as operators and frankly, how to evaluate them from a pure, you know, P&L and balance sheet perspective.
That's absolutely right. And you think about, and maybe jumping into Healthpeak a little bit, but you think about, you know, life sciences as an asset type, you're talking about very mature, you know, established pharmaceutical or biopharmaceutical companies that, you know, have marketed or commercialized products, multi-billion dollar revenue streams, and that's a very easy credit to underwrite. The flip side of that is in that same business, you have early stage startups, right? You've got very intelligent MIT graduate that's got a, you know, desire to explore a particular therapeutic category, and they're taking a chance, they're raising capital, and they're going out and trying to prove the science out. You have, as a real estate investor, you have to understand that risk. And you have to understand that, you know, not every single one of those startups performs and is successful, but some of them hit home runs. Some of them end up being in those large biopharmaceuticals. And as an investor in the industry versus just the asset type, I think it's important to note that, you know, we have to be comfortable with a certain amount of risk. We have to, you know, diligence and understand as best we can, not being PhDs, the science and, you know, what these entrepreneurs are seeking to solve, and being comfortable that we are allocating a substantial amount of capital alongside of them as they look to grow and launch their businesses.
Well, I love that, man. And it's also understanding what implications that credit relates to valuation of the asset, right? To the extent you need to sell it, you know, AAA credit's a little different than non-rated. So that all plays in very directly to the valuation exercise.
That's absolutely right.
All right, Calvin, let's jump into Healthpeak generally. So if you could give us a little bit of profile of who the company is, what the kind of work that they do in the real estate space is, that'd be great.
Absolutely. So Healthpeak Properties, Inc. is a publicly traded real estate investment trust, which means that our capital comes from the public markets. But what we do specifically is we invest in life science real estate, which is traditionally pharmaceutical, biopharmaceutical, medical device companies that occupy our buildings. We build the infrastructure and the research and development capabilities from a real estate perspective for them, and they lease from us.
So I'm going to stop you here because we want to make sure we get this right. So when we think about life science, you said pharmaceuticals and whatnot. So those probably look like traditional office buildings, but they might have things like lab space or like areas with hoods or whatever the heck it is that might be used in allowing them to R&D their products. So just be clear and maybe differentiate, you know, life science from really what I would call traditional office.
Yeah, absolutely. So the simplistic explanation of the difference is, you know, office space is more traditionally, you know, a place for an individual to sit, work at a desk, work at a computer, collaborate, and go home. There might be some amenities in those buildings, but from all intents and purposes, it's more office oriented for that environment. When you get to life sciences, it's kind of a specialty office segment where you have all of those same components as your traditional office building, but the infrastructure required for research and development necessitates a very different design and engineering kind of capacity for the building. So as an example, you have higher HVAC requirements, which means like cool air and hot air exchanges. You need to pump in fresh air into the building more consistently than you would in an office building. You might have heavy equipment on floors, which means you need to structurally prepare the building to accommodate that heavier load. So load capacities are extremely important. Then you also have just naturally laboratory spaces, laboratory equipment, which means there could be chemicals that are being utilized by researchers. There could be, you know, fumes that are being combusted within those spaces that need to be pulled out via exhaust. So there's a lot more heavy infrastructure that goes into the building. But from the outside of the building, it looks just like any old office building, except if you're looking at the rooftop, because there's all of this mechanical equipment and HVAC equipment that differentiates that office building from that laboratory building. But they're, you know, largely very, very similar assets. But not every office building could be a lab building. So I want to make that clear. But you could convert a lab building to office very efficiently because you have more capacity, more load. So the lower kind of, you know, capacity use on the office side could fit into that building easily.
So I got you off the Healthpeak story, but Healthpeak is obviously a large investor in life science, but that's not all you do, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right. That's not all we do. So I'd say about 30-35% of our business is in outpatient medical office. So for those that are listening, that's when you go to a hospital campus and you go and see a physician that's not in the hospital for, you know, an outpatient procedure that could be, you know, just a physical, or it could be, you know, getting a knee scope or something more outpatient in nature. We tend to own those assets that are closely affiliated with the hospital, closely affiliated with major physician practices, and, you know, tend to see slightly higher acuity interactions between physician and patient than you would get in, like, you know, a CVS MinuteClinic. So it's a very different experience. You have a higher need. You need to see a doctor. You'll go there, but you don't need to be in a hospital bed. So you're not in the actual hospital. That segment of our business is very, very critical and important to what we do, because you're really investing in healthcare infrastructure more than anything else. Being tied to the hospital is important to our strategy so that we are able to, you know, directly benefit from the growth and the strategic investment that that health system is making into the hospital that's serving a pretty critical mass within the community. So we tie our investments to the hospital and the health systems directly about 90% of the time. And the last piece of our business is senior living. We've got about, call it 10% of our company that historically was probably closer to 45% of our company pre-COVID that is in that senior housing space, which is, you know, independent living for 55 plus, 65 plus year old folks that want to be more of a community like setting that also have access to, you know, immediate healthcare. So you'll have nurses on staff. You'll have, you know, a resort like experience for the most part, but it allows you to kind of age in place, which is an important piece of a aging population. That demographic is growing, and it's a critical investment need from a real estate perspective. So we've spent a lot of time there, but during the COVID kind of volatility that we experienced in that business, a lot of wage increases, a lot of complexity as a public company, articulating the business to our investors, having, you know, multiple revenue streams across healthcare asset types, it felt like a business that we could exit. So we've kind of prioritized life sciences and medical office and allowed that business to shrink a little bit.
I love it. So just to be clear again to our listeners, is you all own the physical real estate and you lease it to a pharmaceutical company that wants to R&D a new drug. You lease it to a physician practice that needs it for their orthopedic offices. You lease it to a seniors housing operator who will run the product and the property on their own behalf as a private business. So, you know, again, for our listeners here, this is a real estate heavy execution in the healthcare space. So, you know, let's spend more time on life science, because frankly, that's the most interesting. It's been one of the most successful product types, especially since COVID, for I would think our obvious reasons. You know, can we talk a little bit more about what you're doing in that space and maybe where you're doing it and how you're doing it? I know development is part of what you all do. So maybe take us on a tour there for a minute.
Absolutely. So I'm actually sitting here in Boston right now, which is one of the three largest life science markets in the country. So a lot of folks think about MIT and Harvard and that ecosystem that's built around the research that they do. And Cambridge has been, you know, the cornerstone of the life science industry for, you know, the last half century. And we focus our investments specifically in the top three markets in the U.S., which is San Francisco, Boston, as I described, and San Diego. What we do there is we both develop research and development facilities as well as acquire core real estate in those markets. I think a differentiating perspective that we have as an investor in this industry is creating life science ecosystems, investing at scale, and being able to provide a pathway for growth for all of our tenants that need it. So over time, you know, what we hope to have when we look back at our portfolio is a lot of concentrated real estate that is allowing these researchers to collaborate across platforms. So, you know, the Pfizers and the J&Js of the world should be able to sit down and have coffee in proximity to one another. That spurs innovation. And it's important for us to create these highly amenitized environments that bring that research together, all within, you know, common ownership control for ourselves, but within these leading life science markets across the country. So our business is specifically in those three. We do own assets in other great markets like Research Triangle, Raleigh-Durham. We own assets in Salt Lake, Dallas, even, that have life science tenants that are doing life science research and development. But our primary strategy is to invest in those top three.
Are you doing any reposition of traditional office to life science? I know that's been a strategy that some operators have employed. Is that something you all are doing?
You know, we always explore it. There are some office buildings that have the bones and what we like to call the physical capacity to accommodate it. I think when you go to our tenants, their preference is purpose-built. So we tend to build and develop, you know, for their specific needs with the right clear heights from a floor-to-floor perspective. That means when you have a concrete slab of a building that we're standing on, you don't really think about what's happening above the roof, but the lab tenants are very focused on what's happening above the ceiling tiles. As an example, if you have enough room to make changes to your science, make changes to the HVAC ducts, they want to have that flexibility. So if office does not necessitate that much clear, you just wouldn't build it. You don't go out of your way to create more room when that use isn't intended for the building. But when you think about developing it from a, you know, intentional perspective up front, you want to give enough clearance that allows for more flexibility for different types of sciences to play in that space. So we don't tend to look at the office conversions as a place for us to invest.
So I love that. And so, you know, especially sort of the slab to slab nuance and ensuring functionality of a product, almost similar to industrial. One of the issues with life science is it's expensive, right? I mean, so the students should be familiar with the term tenant improvement allowance and just the money that the landlord gives to the tenant to build the space out. Can you talk about that as a fairly unique element of the life science product?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess perhaps just for dollar quantities to make it relevant for folks, in many cases, from a traditional office perspective, you could be looking for a tenant improvement allowance in the $75 to $100 range. In that same submarket, it could be the building next door to that office building. A lab tenant will require 2x that for a tenant improvement allowance from a landlord. So you could be offering $200 per square foot. And that's largely because the infrastructure is far more complex than that of the office tenant. So for investors that are coming into the space, I think they look at that as a daunting capital contribution. For us, we kind of recognize that in order to make such a significant investment in the real estate, where in some cases the tenant, you know, is early stage, is kind of growing into their science, growing into their team, that we're making more of a bet on the industry as a whole than we are in this singular investment in that real estate property. So we'll certainly spend a lot of time with our engineering team and our development team to focus on what's going into the space to ensure that it's reusable for a different type of tenant or a different type of science over time. And so, you know, we're not looking traditionally to exit our investments. We're trying to build the infrastructure that can serve that industry over the long term. So it's got to be flexible. It's got to have the capability to do more than what it's doing for that existing tenant in their use. And I think that's the kind of critical difference between a long-term investor in the industry and those that are coming in to capitalize on that economic opportunity today.
That's right, man. And I love it because there's a lot of learning in there. And back to thinking about credit, you know, the tenant credit, if you're a health peak and you're putting $200 or $300 a foot, you better feel pretty good about the credit of the tenant for fear that they aren't there. But as you said, Calvin, I mean, the hope is whatever you're doing is transferable across tenants, so you're not having to rip all that out and start all over again. So that's a really interesting aspect of this business that I think the students are really in need of understanding, because it's very expensive. You could argue you're getting close to what it would cost to build the building in some markets, and just what you're putting in the form of tenant improvement allowance.
That's absolutely right. I mean, what's attracting investors to the space is that you're able to achieve the highest rents for that type of product in the market. So when you look at traditional office rents versus life science rents, there's a material gap there. And you look at vacancies for office, especially post-COVID versus life science, there's a material gap there. So you start to think a little bit differently, or get a little bit more comfortable with the capital allocation to tenant improvements, with those kind of fundamentals to the business in mind. But, you know, they are still really large dollar commitments for a real estate investor to make, especially when the science is new and you don't necessarily have an established business with revenue streams that can protect your cash flows that you're expecting to receive. You might have tenants that need to be worked out of your building over time. And that risk for an investor like ourselves that has scale in the business, that risk is kind of diminished materially. When you're investing in a single building, and that's where you're allocating all of your capital, you have to be a little bit more cautious about evaluating who comes in and what's the technical components of that build out look like.
So that's great stuff and very well said. So, you know, the market has been crazy for the last, 6 months or so. I mean, you've got rates going up fairly dramatically. There's been a bit of a pause, I think, in terms of the transaction market as sellers absorb what their assets are worth and buyers effectively tell them to maybe no effect. So you kind of have a bit of a quiet period here. Can you talk about what and how your business has evolved over the last 6 months? What are you doing differently or not doing at all today than you were maybe 6 months ago?
Well, I think just like many other people, we're not buying a whole lot right now. And I think the debt markets are putting a lot of pressure on cap rates, frankly. I think, you know, folks aren't able to underwrite deals the way that they were yesterday with, you know, such a low cost of capital. So right now in this environment where folks need to get access to capital, they're either selling assets or they're looking at pretty, you know, high cost of capital solutions, which could be debt that is, you know, SOFR plus name your number at this point, but it's becoming extremely challenging for folks to invest. I think for us, as we look out, we make investment decisions that prepare us to weather through cycles. Right now, I'm spending a little bit more time than historically on development. We're permitting a couple million square feet in each of our markets, which will give us a pipeline for growth when we come out of whatever environment that we're in. And the nice part about development is that it's a long lead time kind of strategic investment strategy that allows us to, you know, both align the capital to go and make those investments, many of which happen in phases. So when you're starting to think about what do you do right now, the best kind of allocation of time and resources might be strategic. And it might be stepping back and saying, what do I want to become in 5 to 10 years? And development really allows you to plan for, you know, future growth. So we're spending a lot more time on the development front. We also very low leverage as a public company that's investment grade. So we tend to think as opportunities become, you know, what I like to say, a little bit more distressed, that we have a lot of liquidity available to us to be able to take advantage of, you know, some of that dislocation in the market. So not to say that we wait for moments like this, but we certainly prepare diligently to be an investor through a cycle, to be able to buy assets when others need to sell and hopefully get great values. So I think for the next 2 years, we're going to sit very cautiously until the market improves, focus on development as a priority, continue to build our land bank where we can, But if we see opportunities that are available, we'll go and pounce on them, largely because we're not beholden to the debt markets to make those investments.
Well, I think the time is really interesting for young people to be learning this business, but it's very instructive in terms of, you know, good balance sheet management versus bad. And meaning bad, meaning high loan to value, a lot of floating rate, right? That's really going to provide those opportunities for you, hopefully in the future. So some of that stuff is really kind of boring and very traditional, meaning run at lower leverage, you know, fix your debt. But in times like this, you're thanking somebody for all of the, you know, that it allows you to sleep at night when others are a little bit nervous.
That's absolutely right. I mean, as a young person, you don't think about those things, right? You're more focused on getting reps, you're getting deal experience and really learning the fundamentals. But, you know, when evaluating where to go, what platform fits best for you, you want to ensure that in a good time, you're spending money and you're getting deals. And then when, you know, times are less good economically, you're still going to be busy. You're still going to learn. You're still going to get exposure the same way that you expected when, you know, anybody could have been a real estate investor. Rising tides is certainly great. And, you hope for those periods for everyone. It's nice to see everyone making money. But when things are, you know, a little bit more volatile, a little bit more uncertain, you know, you want to be in a platform that has taken the appropriate steps to ensure that they can continue to give you experience. They can continue to evaluate things that are going to teach you the fundamentals you're looking for.
Well, I love that. Allow us to transition now to, you and I have had conversations about trying to recruit our students into Health Peak. And if you could talk a little bit about what would an opportunity look like for a student in the way of an internship or, you know, a full-time analyst role out of school, what kind of work would they be doing?
Yeah, so I might step back and say, I got my first shot through an internship at Barclays in investment banking. I think Wall Street's figured it out. The internship program that they've put together there is phenomenal. You get the best talent that get, you know, direct insight into what you do. You get to really understand the analyst program. You get to be a part of it. You're expected and challenged to work as if you are full-time. And I took a lot of that away from the Wall Street industry and brought that into HealthPeak. We launched an internship program about 3 years ago, which was predicated on that same premise that Wall Street had of get your talent from the undergraduate program, teach them, mold them, guide them, and help them grow into whatever it is they want to become. That could be within your company or that could be elsewhere. And so we're hugely investing our recruiting resources in internships. We want more interns. We want more analysts. We think grooming and bringing in more young talent that can come in, learn this business, underwrite assets, really start to investigate why and make strategic, you know, decisions at a more granular level for our capital allocation program, I think is super important to us. So, you know, we'll bring in every single year summer interns that we intend to offer, you know, return full-time analyst positions on our team. And the value in doing so is that everything is kind of progressive. We teach them for 10 weeks. They get exposure to Argus. They get exposure to our financial models, acquisitions, dispositions, development, redevelopment. So they're really starting to see the components of, you know, why we make specific capital decisions. And then when they come back full time, they're hitting the ground running. They've already gotten, you know, a little bit of insight into the company, you know, our operational intricacies internally, but also just what you're expected to do on a day-to-day basis because we had you doing it. So the more time we can spend there investing in young folks, giving them real opportunities to learn, putting them on real projects, real investments that we would actually make as a business, I think both teaches the young people, you know, the skill set of the game, but also it gives us, you know, more opportunities to build strong talent that can help us, you know, grow over time.
Well, I appreciate that. And it's been clear to me from the moment I met you that this is a passion of yours and making sure that we are bringing in the best quality analysts or, you know, early stage professionals as we possibly can. And certainly appreciative of the support of Georgetown. But as we draw this to a close, Kelvin, if you're a current student right now, whether you're an underclassman, a senior, I mean, or even a graduate student in this volatile environment, you know, rising interest rates, which we haven't seen for a while, an inflationary environment, which I've never seen, right? So what would your advice be to these young people today that are interested in a real estate career?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, it might be a little bit unfair to say it this way, but, you know, those large household names have been through this before. The bigger the platform, the more likely that, you know, they've been around for quite some time and they're prepared for this. So to the extent that you can, I would consider exploring some of those household names that you know, the Tishmans of the world, the Heitmans of the world, the Health Peaks of the world, I think that have a long history in this business that recognize that, you know, just because we're in an economic environment that's challenging to invest doesn't mean that we need to stop recruiting strong talent and being prepared for when we're through whatever cycle that we're in or whatever economic environment that we're in. So those institutions are prepared, but, you know, also probably to encourage you and remember that people create generational wealth through these times that are a little bit uncertain. When you do have the capital to allocate, you can make some really, really smart investments right now when things are down. And on the other side of it, the market's looking great. You look like a genius because you were a shrewd allocator of your capital in good times and you took advantage of those opportunities when they became available. So, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there that are going to do brilliant things right now. Getting reps in this industry, getting exposure to it early, being around people that have perhaps failed in a prior cycle, that wisdom goes a long way. However you can get exposed to, you know, real estate right now, you should be encouraged to do it.
Well, I think that's fantastic advice. And I think there's a lot of people that are really excited right now about what the future could bring here from an investment opportunity perspective. And hopefully these are going to be good vintage years for, you know, the industry. And if you have done the right things and you are prepared, you'll be able to take advantage of it. So Calvin, certainly appreciate you coming on to our podcast here, the Steers Real Estate Podcast. Would look forward to seeing you when you're next at campus or in New York or Boston, wherever our paths might cross, but certainly appreciate you making the time for us.
Absolutely, Matt. I appreciate you having me. Thanks.